We come now to the last five chapters of the book of Judges. And these five chapters form some sort of an appendix, chapters 17 to 21. Up until now, the story in Judges has moved through from one judge to the next, recounting the deeds, the events that affected the different tribes and the different eras. But chapters 17 to 21 give us some sort of cross-section, you might say, pointing out the characteristic of Israel at that time when there was no central administration. And there is a refrain which crops up time and again throughout these five chapters, and it goes like this. In those days there was no king in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes. In other words, the tribes all looked after themselves, there was no consideration for others, there was no one to arbitrate in inter-tribal disputes, and generally the situation was fairly chaotic. These five chapters give us many insights into the general conditions which prevailed at that time. However, there's a second reason, I think, that this appendix has been put here, and that is to show us how the fortunes of two of the tribes in Israel changed. One, the tribe of Dan, talked about in chapters 17 and 18, and the other, the tribe of Benjamin, talked about in chapters 19 to 21. Now, firstly, the tribe of Dan. If you cast your mind back to our very first study, I mentioned, when we looked at chapter 1, verse 34, the significance of the statement that the Amorites pressed the Danites back into the hill country, and they did not allow them to come down to the plain. We've seen so far two references to Dan in its tribal territory down there on the Mediterranean coast. Now, the Amorites is a general expression for the Canaanite people, and in this case, of course, the people were the Philistines who controlled that coastal plain area. And the Danites, who were given their tribal territory on that coastal plain bordering the Mediterranean, they were not able to take possession of their territory satisfactorily because the Philistines forced them back up into the hill territory. We saw in the story of Deborah how that Dan was condemned for not joining in the battle, and it said there, why did he abide with the ships? A reference there to its coastal territory down on the Mediterranean. And the other one in the story of Samson, where Samson was from the tribe of Dan, and all his exploits were against the Philistines, who controlled that particular part of the country. So not only were the Danites suffering conflict because of the oppression of the Philistines, they were squeezed on either side by the two most powerful tribes in Israel, that is, the tribes of Ephraim and Judah. So with the Philistines pressing back from the coast, these other two tribes expanding into Danite territory, the Danites were not able to make any sort of satisfactory permanent homeland for themselves, and so they set off in search of a new homeland. Chapter 17 begins not with the Danites, however, but with a man called Micah, and we find that he lived in the hill country of Ephraim. First of all, just to deal with this man Micah, he had stolen a large sum of money from his mother. However, when he heard the blood-curdling curse that his mother placed on the thief, he thought it would be a good idea to hand the money back. In those days, people took curses very seriously, and this curse must have been quite a hot one, and so we find that Micah returned the money. His mother was very thankful, and with the money, she went and made some household gods as an expression of her thanks for having the money returned. Chapter 17, verse 1 tells us about this man, Micah, in the hill country of Ephraim, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse, and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord," which is a rather strange blessing to give a thief. And so he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, "I consecrate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image and a molten image." Now this, of course, is entirely contrary to the law of Israel. Never mind, they set up these idols in the home. Worse than that, in verse 5, Micah had a shrine. He made an ephod and teraphim. An ephod, of course, was the characteristic garment of the high priest. Teraphim were household gods. And he installed one of his sons who became his priest. And we all know that the only priests were to come from one particular family within the tribe of Levi. And here was a man who was not of the tribe of Levi, but yet he made his own son a priest. The whole situation, you can see, is something which is completely contrary to all that Israel had ever been taught in the law of Moses. Now you find that while they were there carrying on their little household religion with their shrine and their priest and their other paraphernalia connected with it, that a young Levite, who happened to live in the tribal area of Judah, passed through that way. He came to the house of Micah, and when Micah found that this man was a Levite, he installed him as priest instead of his own son. Which brings him in verse 13 to say, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest." Well, he was mistaken. But I'm afraid that's the sort of thing that happens. People tend to ignore the more basic elements of their daily lives and think that if one special element that conforms to some regulation is in order, then somehow they've got the blessing of God. Well, I'm afraid that the blessing of God is dependent on things that are far more basic, much more fundamental than that. These organizational details may bring some sort of satisfaction, but they are no guarantee whatever that God is therefore blessing. Micah found this out to his great distress. You come then to chapter 18, and we're introduced now to the Danites. The opening verses outline what I have just said. In those days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites was seeking for itself an inheritance to dwell in, for until then no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. That is, they had not been able to consolidate their position in the area allotted to them. So the Danites in verse 2 sent 5 able men from the whole number of their tribe to spy out the land and to explore it, and they said, "Go and explore the land to find a better dwelling place." These people came into the hill country of Ephraim, and they came to the house of Micah, and they lodged there. They were impressed with Micah's gods. They consulted his gods and his priest to find out if their journey was going to be successful. They were encouraged to think it would be, and so they moved on. In verse 7, they came to Laish, which was way up there in the far north of Palestine, and they saw a people who were there, who dwelt in security after the manner of the Sidonians. They were quiet and unsuspecting, lacking nothing that is in the earth, and possessing wealth, and how they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. In other words, they were sitting ducks. These Danites said, "This is the place, we can clean this lot up fairly easily." And so, confident that they'd found the place where they'd settled, they returned home and told the other people of their tribe. So the people gathered up their belongings and set out for their new homeland. Well, at least the soldiers did to start with, because they had to take the place first. And so this band now of Danite soldiers moves off. You find that on the way they came through the hill country of Ephraim, stopped over at the house of Micah. And they didn't give Micah a very good time. They raided his shrine, they robbed him of his images, they bribed his priest to go with them, and when Micah tried to stop them, they threatened him with violence. And so on they moved, and came eventually to Laish, and they conquered the place in verse 27, taking what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to him. The Danites came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and smote them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no one to deliver the people of Laish, because it was far from Sidon and they had no dealings with anyone. They rebuilt the city, and in verse 29 they named it Dan, after the name of Dan, their ancestor. And then they installed the false religion which they had brought with them from the house of Micah. And from that time on, you find that Dan is the northernmost tribe in Israel. And that's the picture that is presented to us as we move through the remaining books of the Old Testament. Time and again you have the expression, "from Dan to Beersheba," from north to south. And we probably will find some significance in the fact that this false religion they established there found its successor later on when Jeroboam broke away from the kingdom of Solomon and the kingdom of Israel split in two. Jeroboam established a new religion in the northern part of the kingdom, and one of the shrines which he set up was here in this very same city of Dan. So the story tells us two things, basically. It tells us, firstly, how the tribe came to be located in the north, which was in contrast to the area that had been allotted it by Joshua. And secondly, it throws a picture on the idolatry, the lawlessness, the injustice that existed throughout Israel. And there was no point in Micah trying to complain to anybody, because there was no place where he could find justice in any of these intertribal conflicts. And so he had to just look on helplessly as the Danites raided his shrine and moved on. So So much for that story. We come now to chapters 19 to 21, which consists of one unit, and this story concerns the Benjaminites. But once again, before we start to talk about the Benjaminites, we have to talk about a Levite who lived in the tribal area of Ephraim. Now the Levites, as you know, had no tribal area of their own, but they did have cities allotted to them throughout all the tribes of Israel. And here a Levite lives in the tribal area of Ephraim. He had taken a concubine who came from the tribal area of Judah, from Bethlehem, in fact, but after a while she ran away from him. The man went looking for her, and he came to her home in Bethlehem and sought to reclaim his concubine. And the story is outlined for us in chapter 19, and I don't intend reading it right through. If I fill in the details, I think that's sufficient. The father of the girl didn't really want her to go off again, and he tried to persuade them to stay with him, but in the end he had to give in. And so the Levite and his concubine set out from Bethlehem to return to the man's home country in the hill country of Ephraim. Now if you look at the map, you'll find that between Bethlehem in Judah and the hill country of Ephraim, we have this small tribal area of Benjamin. So the most direct route was to go from Bethlehem through the area of Benjamin up into Ephraim. The logical place to spend the night was Jerusalem. But at that time, Jerusalem was under the control of the Jebusites. And the Levite and his concubine thought it would be better not to spend the night among foreigners, but to move on a bit further and camp the night in Gibeah, which belonged to the Benjaminites. And of course in Gibeah they would have been among their own Israelite people, and felt that that was safer than spending the night among foreigners. But they were mistaken. Alas, it is at times true that people do fare worse from the hands of God's people than from the hands of those who are not God's people. And sometimes hopes can be shattered when you find the way God's people respond to certain situations. And here we have a case to illustrate that point. They came to Gibeah, and nobody showed any interest in them whatever. In fact, if it hadn't been for the kindness of an old man, who didn't belong to the tribe of Benjamin either, he just happened to be living there, he was really from the tribe of Ephraim. If it hadn't been for the kindness of this old man, they would have had to spend the night sleeping out in the open in the city square. But the man took pity on them and took them into his home. Now the people of the town knew that they were there, because very soon a bunch of local perverts assaulted the man's house and demanded that he hand over the guest, that he hand over this Levite who was travelling through, so that they could satisfy some of their sexual perversions. The man, the Levite, didn't go out. The owner of the house wouldn't allow him to go out. But this Levite really turns out to be quite a despicable character. What he did instead was to open the door and shove his concubine out so that they could take her and satisfy their lusts on her. What happened was that he just went back inside and closed the door and spent the evening and went to bed. And while that was going on, his poor concubine was being, well, she was really the subject of pack rape, I would imagine, because all through the night she was outraged. And in the morning, when the Levite got up, apparently not too concerned about where his concubine had been during the night, he opened the door to see where she was, and there she was, dead on the doorstep. It was a frightful story, really. What the man did then, that is this Levite, he took the corpse and he cut it into 12 pieces, and he sent these pieces throughout all Israel to call together all the tribes to come and deal with the wicked men of Gibeah. Now that was a very ancient custom, you'll find it referred to elsewhere in the Old Testament, where a corpse was cut up and sent out to the different parts of the land to call the nation together to unite against a common enemy. And the common enemy in this case was, of course, the Benjaminites, or more specifically, the people of Gibeah, which was the Benjaminite town that's involved in the story. Well, when they came, and we're up to chapter 20 now, Gibeah's leaders refused to take any action. Even though the Israelites put pressure on them, they took no action whatever. Here again we have this terrible evil of people being loyal to their own clan group, or to their own family group, or to their own clique, or to their own buddies, rather than being loyal to what is right and true. God's righteousness and God's justice didn't count much for the people of Gibeah, and even the leaders of Gibeah. It was an open and shut case. You could hardly think of any clearer example that needed strong dealing with than this one. And amazing that it is they took the side of the men of Gibeah rather than deal with them. Well, the Israelite people, who by now assembled to exert pressure upon Gibeah, took the matter to higher authority. They took it to the very leaders of the tribe of Benjamin. And, you won't believe this either, even the leaders of the tribe of Benjamin took the side of the men of Gibeah. Well, there was only one thing left, and that was that the people of Israel would have now to go to war against the Benjaminites to force them to deal with this issue. And so war resulted, and it was an absolute bloodbath. You come to chapter 20, verse 18, and we find that the people of Israel, that is the remaining 11 tribes, arose, went up to Bethel, and inquired of God. And they said, "Which of us shall go up first to battle against the Benjaminites?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up first." I believe in the story that follows here, we have a good example of what prayer should be. The story is in three stages. There are three stages in this prayer that I want to look at. Firstly, they ask God who should go up, and God says, okay, Judah goes first, and we find that they lost. The Israelites lost badly. Verse 21, "The Benjaminites came out of Gibeah and fell to the ground on that day, 22,000 men of the Israelites." I guess there are various reasons as to why the war went badly for the Israelites. Firstly, the people of Benjamin knew their own country better. Secondly, they were fighting for their homeland, whereas these other Israelites didn't have quite that same personal interest. They were simply coming to teach these Benjaminites a lesson, whereas the Benjaminites were defending their very life's blood. And so that, you might say, is a further reason as to why the Benjaminites succeeded. Thirdly, the Israelites' greater numbers would not have been of any great advantage in the forest regions where they were fighting. But fourthly, I think the main reason was that the Israelites were simply overconfident. This was going to be a pushover. 11 tribes against one. Nevertheless, you must pray. I mean, that's the way things are done. You have to ask God what to do. And so they go through the motions. And that's the first stage of this prayer. They're simply going through the motions. It's the right thing to do. We must ask God. But I don't think they were really cast upon God for the victory at all. And it can be the same with us. It's the right thing to do. We must open meetings in prayer. We must say grace before our food. We must close discussions with prayer. And sometimes we simply go through the motions. Now, it is right that we do those things. The problem is when we do them without thinking. We are just doing something that really hasn't penetrated into our minds or hearts or spirits at all. And we still think that we're going to do what we're going to do anyway, but maybe we should pray because that's what Christians do. And so they did it, and they came a flop. You find then that, very shocked in verse 23, they went up and wept before the Lord until the evening, and they inquired of the Lord, and they say, "Shall we again draw near to battle against the Benjaminites?" And the Lord said, "Yes, go up again." So again they go up in verse 24, and in verse 25 the Benjaminite men went out against them at Gibeah the second day, and they fell to the ground 18,000 men of the people of Israel, all these men who drew the sword. And so the second time now we find that the Israelites are defeated. And for the second time their prayer hasn't worked. And so you find now that for the third time they come and pray. And notice this time in verse 26 that they are really distressed. "All the people of Israel and the whole army went up and came to Bethel and wept. They sat before the Lord, they fasted that day until evening, they offered burnt offerings, they offered peace offerings before the Lord, and the people of Israel inquired of the Lord," for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas the son of Eleazar ministered before it. "And they inquired, saying, 'Shall we yet again go out to battle against our brethren the Benjaminites, or shall we cease?' And the Lord said, 'Go up, for tomorrow I will give them into your hand.'" You see the element of urgency. They are completely and utterly cast upon God. There's no suggestion now that they're simply doing the right thing. No longer can they just take it easily. They can't take God for granted. And this very often is what prayer is to us. We pray because that's the routine we've been used to. And there's nothing wrong with having a routine. There's nothing wrong with disciplining ourselves to do certain things consistently. But the danger is that sometimes we do them without any great conviction at all. And isn't it true that very often it's not until we are completely and utterly brought to nothing and our self-confidence is smashed that we really then turn to God in complete trust and cast ourselves entirely upon him. That really is what prayer is. I don't believe that prayer is trying to force God's arm, holding a gun at his head, so to speak. I don't believe that prayer is worrying ourselves sick. I don't believe that prayer is heaping up words, vain repetition, like the heathen do, thinking that God is going to hear us because we speak a lot. Prayer is simply casting ourselves upon God and saying, we are unable, we cannot, but you can, and believing that God is sufficient. It's giving God access to do his work to solve the problem. And our prayer is the way we demonstrate our utter trust and dependency upon God. However, that does not mean that we sit back and do nothing. We say, well, it's okay now, God's going to do it all for us. Because you find that the more sincerely they pray, the more diligent they are in what they do. So we don't have a set of circumstances here, or in our Christian lives either, where we become very, very passive and say, well, we don't have to do anything because God's going to do it all. And so we become slack and we just sit back and rest assured that God's going to solve all our problems for us. On the contrary, the more trusting we are in God, the more diligent we'll be to see that we are doing our part properly. And you find as you read the story on that so far from sitting back and resting on their laurels or just saying, oh, well, God will win the victory for us now, it's okay. So far from that, they planned their attack with greater thought and skill than either of the previous two attacks. Now, I'm not going to go through the details, but in verses 29 to 35 you'll find it outlined, and then verse 36 through to the end, the details given. They won a great victory and Benjamin was massacred. Which brings us to verse 46. All who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men that drew the sword, all of them men of valour. Only 600 in verse 47, only 600 escaped. They turned and fled towards the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon and abode there for 4 months. The victory had been so great that one tribe was virtually wiped out in Israel, the tribe of Benjamin. There was a slaughter of not only the men but also the women and the children. It was really a terrible battle. And I believe that the Israelites went far beyond they needed to go. Because when you come to chapter 21, verse 1, the men of Israel gathered. They had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. And the people came to Bethel, they sat there till evening before God, they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly, and they said, O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that there should be today one tribe lacking in Israel? One tribe virtually wiped out. Only 600 men left, and no wives for them. So the problem arose, and this is dealt with now in the remainder of chapter 21, how are we going to find wives for these 600 men so that the tribe can continue to exist? Well, the men had already sworn that they were not going to give their daughters to any of the Benjaminites, that is, the other 11 tribes. The men in these tribes had said, no daughter of ours will be given to a Benjaminite because they're such wicked people. But they found one way of getting some of the wives. They had an examination of all the towns in Israel to find which places had not sent men to join in the combined Israelite force against the Benjaminites. They found that the people of Jabesh Gilead had not sent any, so they raided Jabesh Gilead, and in verse 10, the congregation sent 12,000 of their bravest men, and they said, go and smite the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones. Verse 11, this is what you shall do, every male and every woman that has lain with a man, you shall utterly destroy. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known man by lying with him, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, and that provided 400 of the wives. We're still 200 short, and you have a very quaint little story here of how they got the other 200. There was a religious festival of some sort at Shiloh, and so these other 200 men went and simply abducted 200 young maidens. And there was nothing that could really be done about it. Firstly, they said, if we just take them like this, the fathers of these girls cannot be accused of giving their daughters in marriage, and so they can't be accused of breaking their oath. But we can't be accused of acting like victorious soldiers who go and seize for themselves a girl apiece and go off to have their revelries. So they said, we aren't guilty, and neither are they guilty, and by a sort of gentleman's agreement, we'll just take off these girls and nothing more will be said about it. It's one of these little wrinkles people have as one way of getting around your conscience and getting around a few legalities. Verse 22 of chapter 21 says, "When their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us," that is, these men who are seizing these girls, "we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because A, we did not take each man of them his wife in battle." You see, we went just like soldiers who took the loot and took a girl. "And then B, neither did you give them to them, or else you'd be guilty for breaking your word." And so in this way they got their 200, and so the whole 600 men had 600 wives, and the tribe of Benjamin was not wiped out. But from that time on you find that the tribe of Benjamin was by far the smallest in Israel. And it would be no use, these people, the fathers or anybody else, complaining about what happened, because the last verse says there was no central government to handle any dispute in these intertribal matters, because there was no king in Israel and every man did what was right in his own eyes. So it's a very grim story that we end on, but it gives us an insight into the disorders that existed in the day of Judges. However, all has not yet been said, because if you look at the very next verse, which is the first verse of the book of Ruth, you'll find that that also is set in the day of Judges. So just as in these final chapters of the book of Judges we've seen the disorder and the chaos and the lawlessness and the idolatry and the selfishness and the brutality that there was in Israel, so when we come to Ruth we'll find that amid all this there were those who remained faithful to God. There was consideration and love and fidelity still existent in Israel, and to those who were faithful to him, God in turn showed himself faithful. And that will be our final study in the book of Ruth.